made for rehabbing the factory. He'd agreed to move his HQ from the Southside neighborhood he'd worked in before. But the gate had to stay open, the offices had to be inviting, because he'd wanted humans and supernaturals to feel comfortable visiting here. Now it looked more like a campus than an industrial relic. I walked to the admin building, waved at the guard who sat near the entrance. Clarence Pettyway had guarded the office since I'd been old enough to visit, and always had a book in hand. This time he looked up from a faded paperback and lifted a hand in a wave. His dark skin was liberally wrinkled, but his eyes were still sharp.
"Well, if it isn't little Elisa Sullivan, although not so little now."
"Mr. Pettyway, it's good to see you." I gestured to the book. "What's in the queue today?" He turned it over, revealing the creased cover of Homer's The Odyssey.
"Hope to get in a little classical reading this week. Working on one of those top 100 reads lists. What brings you by?"
"I'd like to speak with one of your prisoners, Riley Sixkiller." The smile disappeared, and his face went hard. Mr. Pettyway was retired from the CPD, but he was still a cop at heart.
"He's in lockup, and Mr. Dearborn didn't authorize you through."
That was a tricky one. "He doesn't know I'm here," I confessed. "But Riley's been a friend for a really long time, and I think someone set him up. I'd just like a few minutes to hear his side of the story. I know I'm asking you for a lot, but I promise I'd only need a few minutes." It took nearly a minute for him to relent, to rise and put down his book, then walk me down the hallway to the dismal concrete corridor that led to the holding facility. Mr. Pettyway pressed a hand to the security plate, and the door popped open with a loud, mechanical click. He held it before it could close, looked back at me again.
"I'm allowing this because of your great-grandfather, and because I figure you're a pretty good judge of character. But you'll be careful."
"I promise." And I could handle myself better than Mr. Pettyway imagined. The room was enormous, big as a football field with walls 20 feet high, and it was empty except for the glass and concrete cubes arranged in a tidy grid. No steel, no bars, but cages all the same. The first cube in the first row was empty, as were most of the others. Riley's cube was the second from the end. I found him pacing behind the glass wall. He wore pale gray scrubs and white socks, and the thin fabric somehow made him seem smaller. Behind him, the cube was empty but for a slab bed built into the wall, a sink, and a toilet. The ceiling was glass, but the other three walls were concrete, to provide a little privacy. And like most prisons, I guessed, it was depressing. I waited until he lifted his gaze, and then saw hope flare and fade again. I was instantly sorry I'd put it there.
"Elisa, you come to stare at the animal in the cage?"
There were dark circles under his eyes and a bruise on his jaw, probably from fighting back against his arrest. "I came to check on you, and ask you some questions."
"I've already talked to the cops, the pack."
His voice was dismissive, his words short. I couldn't exactly blame him for being angry. "I know, and I know you didn't hurt him, Riley. I know you didn't kill Tomas." His eyes widened, softened. "Tell me what happened," I said.
"I don't know."
He squeezed his eyes shut, rubbed his temple.
"And trying to remember makes my head scream."
"Okay," I said, filing that away. "Then tell me what you do remember."
"Brisket."
Not what I'd expected him to say. "Brisket?"
"The pack supplied the meat for the party, including brisket we'd smoked at Little Red in the new kitchen. There's a mesquite pit, but I guess that doesn't matter. I got to the party same time as the van, helped unload the trays.
He held out his arms in a rough rectangle.
You know those big aluminum pans?
Sure, the catering pans. I saw you carrying them. He nodded.
I brought them in, got them situated.
And then what?
I went out to the party, had a whiskey, Cadigan has the good stuff, and walked around, talked to people. I ate and drank and listened to the music, talked to my pack mates about the socks, this problem Cole is having with one of his cams.
Cams?
On his ride, engine cam.
Ah, got it. Keep going.
We thought about asking if we could take a dip in the pool after the party died down. I figured Sullivan would be game. I wanted to check the water, so I kneeled down, put my fingers in. It was warm, but not too warm. And then,
he winced, rubbed his temple again.
And then I saw something, or heard something. I don't remember.
Something caught your attention?
Yeah, but I don't know what. And then I smelled blood, and I looked around.
He stopped, brow furrowed, and pressed a clenched fist against his forehead. And, like he'd been holding in pain, exhaled loudly. I moved closer to the grass. Do you need me to get someone, Riley, for the pain?
No, I can handle it.
But he walked to the bed, sat down, and cradled his head in his hands. His size made it even harder to see him hurting. He was strong, so pain that brought him down would have probably been unbearable to me.
The next thing I knew, he said without looking up, you were standing in front of me, and the woman behind you was screaming. Then the cops showed up.
He looked up again, misery and anger warring in his eyes.
And here we fucking are.
Have you ever had gaps in your memory like that?
No. When my brain was working again, I recognized the man on the bricks, the delegate from Spain, the one who raged about shifters and vampires working together, then nearly ran into me and tried to blame me for it.
Did you know him before the event? Had you talked to him before? He lifted his head and his eyes seemed clearer, as if the pain had vanished because we'd switched topics. Could magic have done this? Affected his memory and made it painful to access?
Neither. His name, photo, were probably in the security dossier.
He tried for a grin.
But I don't pay much attention to vampires who live a continent away.
Since I hadn't given much thought to shifters while I'd been in Paris, I couldn't fault him for that. Would anyone want to hurt you? I asked.
I'm a shifter, he said,
as if that explained it completely.
I've got enemies like everyone else.
His eyes darkened.
But my enemies would come after me. They wouldn't kill someone else.
Who are those enemies? I asked. He rose, walked back to the glass.
You know I did time, before the pack.
Yeah. Lulu had explained it. Riley was born in a small town in Oklahoma, but left when he was 16, looking for excitement. He ended up in Memphis in an independent band of shifters, the rogues of the shifter world, who didn't recognize the authority of any apex outside their own family. Unfortunately, it had been less a family than a gang, and he'd done time for assault and larceny before he tried to pull a con on the wrong shifter. Gabriel hadn't fallen for it, and he'd apparently seen past the grift. He pulled Riley into the pack, and Riley had been on the straight and narrow, or as straight and narrow as shifters' paths got, since then.
Some of the family weren't happy about my decision.
They aren't in Chicago, though, are they? Weren't they in Memphis?
Yeah, and I don't see them traveling all the way out here to make trouble for me. They were pissed, but I wouldn't say they were invested, if that makes sense.
I nodded. It does.
Lise, I don't have any idea why someone would have killed that vampire, or made it look like I did it. I can't remember what happened, and I'm in this goddamned cell for no reason except, as far as I can figure, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
I know, Riley, and I'm sorry. We're all working to figure out what happened. He nodded, but misery swam in his eyes. If you think of anything, let me know. Or talk to Connor or Gabriel. Just tell someone.
I will.
I nodded and turned, guilt following me like a shadow.
Elisa.
I glanced back at him. He'd moved closer to the glass, flattened a hand against it.
Animals shouldn't be caged.
The magic and pain and budding fury that swirled in his eyes had me shivering. The grounds of Cadogan House were darker than they had been the night before. The party gear was gone, and the sky was overcast, the air warm and damp and still, like misery itself had been trapped in the humidity, ready to suffocate. A swag of black taffeta and crepe hung from the front gate and the front door, a memorial to the immortal killed within. It was quiet inside, too, and the air was still thick with the smell of yesterday's flowers. I found my parents in my father's office. They stood together, watching the screen my mother held out.
"Good evening," my father said, glancing back when I stepped into the doorway.
"Hi," I said, moving to them. "How are you doing?"
"We are concerned," he settled on. "We had a moment of silence at dusk in honor of Tomas, but that still feels insufficient."
I reached out, took his hand. "I'm sorry."
"So am I," he said. "I was no fan of Tomas. He was pompous and a little paranoid. But that doesn't excuse murder."
"Is there any news about the investigation?" I asked, wishing for some smoking gun that would prove Riley innocent, and that I hadn't entirely misjudged his character. My mother glanced at my father, then at me. I didn't take that as a good sign. "We've got bad news and odd news," she said. "Give me the bad news first." Riley's fingerprints were the only prints on the knife, and they were in the right place. She held up a fist like she was gripping an invisible knife, ready to strike. The perpetrator could have wiped off the other prints, and would have done just that if this was the setup it looked like. But the absence of other prints still tied the knot in my stomach a little tighter. "And the odd news?" "The blip in the surveillance video," my mother said, "was magical." I don't understand what those words mean together.
"I told you," my father said with a smile for her. "I didn't get it either the first time."
"Kelly says the missing video wasn't caused by a technological problem," my mother said. "It was magical in origin." I frowned. "Someone spelled the camera?" "She doesn't know, and there's nothing before or after the blip that shows who made the magic." "A shifter couldn't work a spell," I said. "And even if they could, it's not a very shifter thing to do. To kill someone at a party, in public, and then blank out the footage?"
"It's pretty passive-aggressive," my mother agreed. "Shifters tend to take more ownership of their behavior."
"What about the fence where the killer came over? Have they found anything there?"
"Nothing," my mother said. "The ombudsman continues to investigate," my father said, and I could hear the irritation and the warning in his voice, that I wasn't supposed to get involved. I wasn't going to argue with him, especially since my best argument involved telling him his daughter wasn't a real member of his house.
"I'm going to see Lulu," I said. "I don't know if she'll want to talk about this or not, but I figure I could make the offer."
"Of course you should," my mother said,
Do you want to take her something from the kitchen? It was just the kind of thing my mother would ask. No, but thanks. You'll let me know if you find out anything else? We will, she said, and give our best to Lulu. I will. And hoped that would be enough. I wanted to talk to Lulu, and I wanted to talk to Connor, not necessarily in that order. But first, I wanted to take another look at the scene of the crime. Tonight, the house's cafeteria was full of vampires taking their first meal of the day before heading out to their jobs in or outside Cadogan. The smell of bacon permeated the space, and I was half surprised my mother didn't mention it was a bacon day. She and bacon had a special relationship. It was humid on the back lawn, the torches and lanterns gone, the yard dark but for the occasional path lights and moonlight that filtered through the trees. No vampires, no humans, no CPD crime scene techs. The site of Tomas's death was empty of people tonight, which seemed equally fitting and sad. Even if I hadn't known the way to the patio, the scent of blood would have drawn me. It had been washed away, the scene already photographed and imaged, but it still stained the air. The patio bricks were laid in a hexagon. There was a kitchen on one side, and a low brick rail on the other that provided seating. I walked across the brick from one end to the other, gaze sweeping the ground for anything unusual, anything that might have been missed. I found nothing. If anything had been here, it had probably been taken by the forensic team or determined to be insignificant and washed away, just like the blood. I checked the grass nearby, found nothing but the divots where supernaturals had scuffled in soft grass. But then something crunched underfoot. Half expecting to find a squished bug, I lifted my shoe to find something shiny wedged between grass and brick at the edge of the patio. I crouched down. It was a brooch, a complicated knot in a careful gold filigree. I didn't recognize the piece or the design, but it was near the site of the murder, so I figured that made it worth another look. I reached into my pocket, pulled out the handkerchief I'd borrowed from my father the night I'd arrived and had meant to give back. I picked up the brooch, wrapped it carefully, and put it away again. Maybe it was evidence, maybe it wasn't. But at least it was something. 12. I contacted Sari and Marion when I was in an auto again. Based on their expressions on my screen, the information about the fingerprints and magical tampering of the surveillance video didn't thrill them.
A shifter could not affect electronics with magic, Marion said.
No, they couldn't.
But that does not exonerate your friend. It indicates only that there was at least one other party involved in the murder. Someone with magical skills and the intention to use them to cover up a crime.
That made it sound like a conspiracy, which didn't bode well for the peace talks or peace in Chicago. Or one person who wanted to cover their tracks, I said.
Yes, Marion said. That is possible.
But she didn't sound convinced.
What are your next steps?
I've talked to Riley, and I'm going to talk to Connor Keene, Gabriel's son. He's Riley's friend and would know if Riley had enemies.
Or a temper?
It was a logical question, but it suggested she wasn't buying my theory. If he has a temper, I've never seen it. But I understand and respect your concerns. That's why I'm going to talk to Connor. If I learn anything else, I'll let you know.
That is as much as you can do, Marion said. But I fear for this process. Someone wished to interrupt it, and they have succeeded.
I could hear the music a block before I arrived at Little Red, the low bass line, throbbing drums, and thrumming guitar. Either the pack had turned up the jukebox, or there was a concert tonight at the bar. I guessed the answer by the dozens of gleaming bikes lined up outside. I skipped the bar entrance, went in through the office. Berna sat in the lobby on her scooter, staring intently at an e-reader beneath an enormous pair of pink and rose gold headphones. I guess she didn't like the band. She looked up when I walked in, gaze narrowed. "Connor," I mouthed.
"Garage,"
she said, returning her gaze to the book. Permission enough, so I headed through the hallway she'd led me down before. When in doubt, I turned toward the noise. The door to the bar vibrated on its hinges with each strum of the bass guitar from a band covering Jimi Hendrix's All Along the Watchtower. I pushed open the door and was nearly pushed back by the deafening sound. The tables were full, the air smelled of smoke and spilled beer, and the room buzzed with magic strong enough to raise the hair on my neck. Shifter magic was a powerful thing, and there were a lot of shifters here. That gave it a dangerous edge. There were also plenty of humans in the crowd, mostly 20 and 30-somethings who probably hadn't come to the bar for the music, but for the magic, for the power and the possibility something might happen. The door to the garage was closed, but shifter-free. I walked inside and closed the door, which muted the sound of the band to a dull roar. I didn't see any shifters, but the magic in the air said I wasn't alone. A low stool rolled through the bikes on the other side of the room with a squeak of rubber on linoleum. On it sat a narrow-eyed Miranda. She wore skinny jeans, black boots that laced up to her knees, and a black bra beneath a distressed black tank. Her hair was curlier today, soft, dark waves that framed her face perfectly. The boots said she was ready to fight, and so did the expression on her face. "You aren't wanted here," she said, rising. "You arrested our packmate." "The CPD arrested your packmate because he was literally holding the murder weapon." But I held up a hand before she could argue. "And I know he didn't do it, so save us both the lecture. I'd like to talk to Connor." "He's busy trying to take care of Riley, and it's 2 days before Alaska." It took me a second to get the reference. "Oh, right. The road trip." "The return trip," she said. "It's important for the pack." "I'm sure it is." But I didn't move. "I'd still like to talk to him." She rolled her eyes. "Look," I said, "I get that you have a problem with me, although I don't know how that's possible since we don't actually know each other." Lips pursed, she looked me over. "I know enough about you and your kind, brat." "That word doesn't do the damage you think it does, but good try." Irritated magic rolled across the room. The door opened behind me, and she looked over my shoulder at someone who'd entered. "Connor," she said, "you have a visitor. The vampire's here again."
"I see that,"
Connor said, walking toward us. He wore jeans and a gray little red t-shirt that snugged against his sculpted abdomen.
"Give us a few minutes."
"She wants to talk about Riley. He's important to me, too."
"Miranda."
Anger boiled in her eyes, but she kept her mouth closed. She walked to the bar door, music spilling into the room like a cresting wave when she opened it, then slammed it behind her again. "She doesn't much like me," I said.
"No, she doesn't. You're not her type."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning Miranda's a good pack member. You're not pack. And like many shifters and vampires, she has very specific ideas about loyalty."
Connor kept his gaze on the closed door.
"She's also worried about Riley."
"Were they together?"
"No,"
he said. He looked back at me, eyebrows furrowed, dark slashes over his blue eyes. Like a man who had things to say but wasn't ready to say them. It wasn't hard to guess what he was thinking.
We don't need more vampire involvement where Riley is concerned.
What happened to friendship? He gave me a flat look.
He was arrested at Cadogan House.
Not by vampires. You know why they had to arrest him. The evidence was there, Connor.
He's in a cage.
I know. I went to see him. Connor wasn't the type to show surprise. He generally rolled with the current, whatever it might have been. That was the upside, I guess, of not being too focused on rules. But he definitely looked surprised now.
You went to see him?
I'm not your enemy, and I'm not his enemy. I don't know how or why he ended up holding a knife, but I know he didn't kill Tomas. So I went to talk to him, and to find out if he knew anything else.
What happened to the deal with the mayor's office? The ban against Cadogan involvement? I thought you stuck to the rules.
I do, but I'm not a Cadogan vampire. He blinked. Whatever he'd expected me to say, it wasn't that.
What does that mean?
I offered my theory, watched confusion change to disbelief, then appreciation.
You think the Ombudsman will buy that? Or your father?
50-50 on the Ombudsman. And if I have to use it, it's going to hurt my father. But my father's not being framed for a murder he didn't commit. Connor watched me again for a long moment, then nodded.
All right. What did you learn by talking to him?
That he doesn't remember anything. That he blacked out or he's missing time. And he has one hell of a headache when he tries to remember. Connor's brow furrowed.
He told me about the headaches. He was obviously in pain, and I asked him about it. But I didn't make the connection to his memory.
I nodded. Someone was very careful to hide their tracks. Unfortunately, that means Riley can't tell us what actually happened. And I didn't get anything else specific. Nothing about Tomas or anything weird that happened at the party that might have triggered someone to frame him. Did you get anything else?
No.
Is there anyone who'd particularly want to hurt him? Not just pack enemies, but personal ones? He walked to Thelma, whisked an invisible spot of dust from her leather seat.
Not that I'm aware of. You know Riley, Lise. He's likable. Big and a little gruff, but, and I'll deny it if you tell him I said this, a teddy bear. He'd chew off his own arm and offer it up if you needed one. That's why he's one of us.
What about Tomas? Connor sneered, and still managed to make the expression sexy. There was, apparently, no expression that didn't look good on the prince, and that was just irritating.
My only knowledge of him comes from his displays at the theater and the party. He's not a man I'd ever want to know, or know more about. I couldn't really argue with that.
Okay, I said, and pulled the handkerchief from my pocket, showed him the brooch. Do you know what this is? He glanced at it, lifted his brows.
No. Should I?
I don't know. I found it on the patio at Cadogan House.
Did someone drop it at the party?
I don't know, I said, and this time, looking at the brooch tickled a memory I couldn't fully access. But before I got any further down that path, the door opened, more waves of music following the big man who walked inside. This was Eli Keen, Connor's uncle. He was tall, with tan skin, broad shoulders, and dark wavy hair that skimmed the shoulders of his shirt. There were strands of silver in his hair and the scruffy beard that covered his jaw, and they made him look more experienced, more powerful. Eli looked at Connor, then at me. If he thought anything was odd about a vampire standing in the pack's garage, he didn't mention it. He gave me a nod.
Elisa, heard you were back.
I nodded back, tucked the handkerchief back into my pocket. Hey, Eli, building looks good.
It does,
he agreed. There was pride in his eyes, but his expression stayed somber.
You're needed, he said to Connor. I'll be there in a minute.
Eli looked at him as if debating whether to repeat the order, then slid me a glance before looking back at his nephew.
Make it quick.
He disappeared again, leaving the cry of a squealing guitar in his wake. The show must go on, I said when the door closed.
That's what they say. Responsibilities.
Alaska?
Alaska, he said, but his eyes were shadowed. He was supposed to go with us.
Riley? Connor nodded. I'm sorry, and that someone is using the pack for this.
Why do you care?
The words put me on my guard, but the tone was quiet and seemed honest. Because as much as you drive me crazy, I know you. And I know Riley. And it's not fair. He watched me for a minute.
That's some of it, but not all of it.
I didn't like that he'd seen something I wasn't entirely ready to talk about. But I'd already crossed that threshold with him once. Because of the Eiffel Tower. He frowned.
The attack?
I nodded. It was bad, Connor. The vampires walked through a park where people were just hanging out, being happy. And they killed them because they were pissed at someone else. Vampires are fighting like damned children, and they're hurting other people to do it.
You think vampires are behind this?
Not necessarily, but I think it's wrapped up in the peace talks, and that's a big, messy bundle of supernaturals. I know Riley wouldn't do it. And I don't like people using my father or his house for murder. There was something deeply considering in his eyes, and I nearly looked away from the intimacy of his evaluation.
You've gotten kind of impressive, Brad.
I narrowed my gaze. I'm not sure that's a compliment.
It is.
He gestured toward the door.
Fascinating as it is to see this other side of you, I need to get back to work. But you'll let me know if you find anything.
Sure, I said, and I left him to prepare for his journey. Lulu had grown up in a house in Wicker Park not far from Little Red. When she got a place for herself, she changed neighborhoods, moving to the near north side and a loft apartment. Since I'd failed on the souvenir front, I stopped for coffee on the way. I climbed out of the auto to look up at the unassuming brick building, the long rows of windows. It looked like a warehouse, which was the architectural calling card for this particular neighborhood. The other tenants had names listed beside the buzzers for their apartments. The one I assumed was hers, since her name wasn't listed, bore a splotch of red paint. I mashed the button with an elbow.
What? I'm working.
Her voice was irritable. It's me, I said, and the locks disengaged with a snick. I rearranged the coffee cups and yanked open the door before it locked again, then slipped inside and climbed the wide and beaten stairs in the unassuming lobby. She was on the fourth floor, and one of only two doors in the long hallway. I walked to hers, and since my hands were full, knocked with an elbow.
It's open!
She yelled out. I managed it awkwardly, found myself looking down at a slender black cat. It stared up with green eyes, a swishing tail, and a very suspicious expression.
The cat is giving me dirty looks, I said.
That's Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Hi, Eleanor. I gave her a smile. In response, she hissed at me.
She doesn't like nicknames, Lulu called out. It's Eleanor of Aquitaine or nothing. I lifted an eyebrow at the cat. She stared back, unblinking and unmoved. It occurred to me that I didn't know any vampires who had cats. Maybe cats didn't like vampires. But I was an adult, so I'd try again. Hello, Eleanor of Aquitaine. Her tail stopped flicking, but her expression didn't change. Then she turned and walked away, tail still swishing as she moved. Rude, I murmured, and kicked the door closed. Lulu's loft was a rectangle of space with a cluster of rooms in the middle. The floors were wide planks of well-used wood. The walls were sandblasted brick and were hung with enormous paintings in brilliant colors, art show posters, and weavings of tufted yarn. She'd put some kind of colored plastic over the glass in the long row of casement windows, so a rainbow spilled into the loft from the streetlight outside. There was a low couch along one wall, a plank coffee table in front of it. In the middle of the room sat a long table topped with rolls of canvas, cups of paintbrushes, and tubes and jars of paint. Part of the table slanted up to hold a work in progress at an angle for easier painting. Lulu stood in front of it, dousing a brush in clear liquid. There was a kitchen along the wall in the middle, a long bank of open shelves and cabinets with an island in front, and on the facing wall, an old-fashioned secretary cabinet with an aluminum chair in front, a pile of bills on the open desktop. This place is amazing. Thanks. She went to the sink, washed her hands. I brought coffee from Leo's. Mocha for you, double espresso for me. I put hers on the island, took mine, and opened the tab that kept liquid from sloshing in the auto. They deducted extra funds from your account if you dirtied up the interior. Lulu laughed. Hugh made it nearly 48 hours without a Leo's run. Not even, I said. My parents met me at the airport with a cup. Addict. Loud and proud. Lulu snorted. Either way, thank you, because I need the jolt. I've been at this for hours. She rolled her shoulders as she dried off her hands, then moved toward the coffee. I walked to a bookshelf made of plumbing fixtures and unpainted boards, surveyed the photographs spread across the top. There was one of Lulu's parents, one of the cat, and one of us. We'd been in junior high, made up almost entirely of knees and elbows, and convinced we were badasses. A lot of leggings in this picture, I said lightly. And pointy eyeliner. We must have been going through a phase. Evidently so. Riley didn't kill anyone, Lulu said suddenly. So much for the preliminaries. I looked back and found Lulu at the island, one leg crossed over the other, the drink cradled in her hands, and misery in her eyes. No, I said, walking back. I don't think he did. I think someone else did, then set him up for it. She looked up. Why would they do that? I don't know yet. Have you talked to him recently? No. She adjusted in her seat, obviously uncomfortable. Not since the breakup, when we had to exchange some stuff. But other than that, no. I haven't talked to him. She sipped her drink as if looking for something to do, something to fill the quiet that she couldn't fill with words. He's at the brick factory, I said. If you want to go see him, I mean. I don't think that would be a good idea. But the look on her face said she was conflicted. Okay. I climbed onto a stool, sipped my coffee. What about the pack? Do you know of anything weird going on with them? Anything someone might target Riley about? No, or not that I'm aware of. Would you be? She frowned. I don't know. I've been at Little Red more in the last few weeks than I have in the past 4 years, so I'm around. She lifted a shoulder. You know they're going to Alaska? I nodded. Yeah, Riley was supposed to go with them. He won't be going now, or at least not until this is cleared up. But I don't see how that would matter enough for someone to kill over it. Me either. Okay, I said, and put down the coffee cup. I shifted on the stool to pull out the bauble I'd found at Cadogan House. What about this? She didn't take the handkerchief or the object, but leaned over to peer at it. There's magic in this, Lulu said. You don't have to use magic to recognize it. I didn't detect any magic, so it must have been feigned. Does it look familiar to you? No. I mean, it's pretty, but not familiar. What is it? I don't know. I found it at Cadogan House, near where Tomas was killed. Maybe someone dropped it, Lulu said. I mean, there was a party, right? Doesn't mean it came from the killer. No, it doesn't. But there was still something about it that seemed familiar, and that bugged me. Didn't you take video of the reception or something? Yeah, for Sari, I said absently, peering at the gold. There was dirt in some of the filigree, but that might have been from my stepping on it. Did you want to watch it? No, she chuckled. Aren't there supernaturals in that video? You know, she waved a finger at the brooch. Dressed up? I looked up, stared at her for a moment. Oh my God, you're a genius. She huffed, sipped her drink. You may be the Watson to my Sherlock. Who's your Moriarty? TBD, she said. Let's see some fringe and fangs. There wasn't much of either in the reception. Plenty of silk and sequins, a dryad with skin patterned like birch bark, and, of course, Tabby, who was too sexy for her shirt. But we didn't see the brooch, not pinned to a sash or a bodice or a hat. Maybe you're right, I said. Maybe it's a total coincidence. A bit of jewelry dropped sometime between 1883, that's when Cadogan House was founded, and earlier tonight. Or it could be a fairy. I tossed my empty cup in the recycling box. Yeah, there were a few fairies there, but more vampires. No, not any fairy. This fairy. I turned back. What? With a satisfied smile, she pointed at the screen. I found your brooch wearer. You are kidding. I hustled back to Lulu in the screen, watched the video she'd pulled up and enhanced. Something glinted on the tunic worn by one of the fairies, tall and pale, with sleek, dark hair and chiseled cheekbones, who followed Claudia and Ruadon in the procession down the runway. As he moved, the glint resolved. The gold knot was pinned at his throat. You were not kidding. Nope. Do you know him? No. I hadn't seen him at the party, but that didn't mean he hadn't been skulking around. Of course, the fact that a fairy had worn the pin found near the crime scene didn't mean it had been used to commit murder. It could have just fallen off the tunic. Why would a fairy have killed an ambassador from Europe? She asked, when the parade wound to a close. I don't know. The fairies were dicks at the first session, and so was Tomas. Both of them railed about vampire and shifter conspiracies. And then a shifter is accused of killing a vampire. That's convenient. I looked at her. Yeah, I said slowly. That is convenient. Maybe they did want to disrupt the peace talks. I mean, that mission was at least partially accomplished by the fairies when they barged in yesterday. But the murder got tonight's session canceled, too. But it seems really indirect. Why not just attack the talks themselves? Literally, not in the fairy interruption way. Or take credit for the murder because you think it will get you some political traction. I don't know. She put down the screen, folded her hands on the island, and looked at me. Maybe we should ask them.
Ask who?
The fairies. I have a car. She held up her fists and mimed a steering wheel. We get into it, go to the castle, and ask them.
No, I said. Absolutely not. That's too dangerous.
And a violation of so many rules that even Connor might have balked at it.
It's not a risk-free idea, she admitted. But what's the other option? We sit around while Riley's in lockup?
We could end up dead.
That's true for you every time the sun rises. The only thing that matters is what you do in the dark.
I narrowed my gaze at her. That was really philosophical. She lifted a shoulder.
I've been reading more since you've been gone. I've even got a card for the Cadogan House Library.
How did you get a library card?
I'm a friend of the house, she said dryly. Supernatural parentage has some advantages.
Doesn't that violate the magic ban? I asked.
We aren't talking about magic, she said, hopping off the stool and emptying her cup. We're talking about murder and a friend of mine. Why do you think I'm painting that mural?
She walked to the kitchen counter, plucked a key fob from a silver bowl, looked back at me with a dare in her eyes.
Are we doing this?
I tapped fingers against the granite. I shouldn't have been considering it. I don't want this blowing back on my parents. But I thought of Tomas, of blood spilled at my father's house. I thought of Riley in his sad gray scrubs and the desperation in his eyes. And I thought of the future. If the perpetrator was willing to kill at Cadogan and frame a good man, what else were they willing to do? How could I just stand by?
This has to be low-key, I said, decision made. No snark, no sarcasm. We just ask polite questions.
I'd really prefer the ombudsman not hear about this.
Lulu winced.
Shit, I forgot about that. The deal with Cadogan House.
I think I have an out there, I said, and told her my theory. Her whistle was long and low.
Your dad is not going to like that, you not being an official Cadogan vampire.
No, he is not, and the ombudsman might not buy it, so we need to be really, really careful. And when it came to supernaturals, even really careful could go bad. I tried to figure out how to politely phrase the next question without expressly mentioning her magic avoidance.
If things go bad, can you take care of yourself?
I've been learning Krav Maga. And there's also this.
She moved to a narrow door, pushed aside a broom and mop that tried to escape, and pulled out a black duffel bag. She brought it back, put it on the counter, and unzipped it.
Damn, Lulu.
It was filled with weapons, mostly bladed. Sheathed knives, throwing stars, handguns, even a wakizashi, a smaller sword carried by samurai as a companion to the longer katana.
Dad taught me a few things, she said.
I'd forgotten Ketcher had been an expert, had given my mother her first katana lessons. From what I knew about him and his particularity where weapons were concerned, I didn't think he'd approve of Lulu's everything in the duffel bag method of storage. She pulled out the wakizashi and a handgun, then re-zipped it and put it away. She belted the short sword expertly, checked the handgun expertly to see if it was loaded, then slipped it into her pocket.
Ready to go?
I can see that.
One thing,
she said, then held up a finger. She pulled a sticky note from a pad on the counter, scribbled something, and stuck the note to the refrigerator door. I stepped closer to read it. Gone to question fairies, it read, then listed the date, followed immediately by, if not back in 24 hours, please retrieve bodies.
You've also gotten more morbid in my absence,
I dwell in darkness, she said flatly. The ravens are my minions and the moon my master. I know I haven't lived in Chicago for a while, but do you really think we can just drive right up to the castle and ask for an invite?
We'll find out, she said, then looked down at the cat. Eleanor of Aquitaine, guard the door. We're going hunting. 13. Calling Lulu's vehicle a car was too generous. It was, at best, a caricature of a car. A soup can rolled onto its side, with pasted-on tires that had more in common with donuts than road-ready wheels. An auto could be here in minutes, I said with a grimace.
Autos are corporate. Corporations lie.
She unlocked the door, began to wedge her way inside.
It's small and it's ugly, but it runs on used cooking oil. Zero waste, remember?
That explained why it smelled like peanuts and fried chicken. I folded myself, origami style, into the front seat. No point in paying for aesthetics or space.
Exactly.
She hit the ignition, which I assumed released a snack to the hamsters under the hood. I hoped to God we wouldn't need a getaway car. The moon was nearly full, only a fingernail of shadow along the edge, and it cast an eerily strong glow over the gravel where we'd parked across the street from the fairy's home. When they'd followed vampires, shifters, and sorcerers into the public sphere 20 years ago, they'd bought an unused tract of land in South Loop along the South Fork of the Chicago River. The strip of land had been an empty lot for years. They'd built a fence around the property, and a castle in the middle. A narrow path of crushed white stone led onto the grounds beneath an arched gate in the iron fence. At the end of the straight drive was the dark stone wall of the castle. There were round, crenellated towers at each corner, square towers at the midpoint of each side, and a gatehouse in front.
You have to go through the gatehouse to get in, Lulu said. The courtyard's behind that. It's called a bailey, and it circles the building that holds the living quarters. That's called the keep. There will probably be a lot of guards.
You really looked into this fairy castle thing.
I'm nosy.
We could skip the steel, she said, looking down at the wakizashi in her hand.
Reduces the odds of the OMB finding out about it.
No weapons is not an option. We both go in with what we can carry. And are people really calling it that?
OMB? Yes. Fewer syllables.
I don't approve.
Color me shocked.
Let's go, I said, casting a final glance at the moon. Not even full, and it was still nearly bright enough to read by. We wouldn't exactly be making a secret approach. They'd see us coming up the path. But maybe that would make them feel more secure about our visit, and less likely to freak out. My chest tightened when I considered the possibility the monster would show itself on this little field trip, which was already a bad idea. But there was nothing I could do about that now.
Elisa, she asked as we walked down the path.
Yeah?
Why are you really doing this?
I looked at her.
What do you mean? I know this is risky for you. Why are you doing it?
Because he was nice to me, important to you, and part of the pack. That makes him important to me. She blew a breath through pursed lips like she was working to control tears. But she held them in. You know you don't have to do this, right? She looked at me, then looked away, chin set.
My family and friends are magic. Saying no to it.
She paused, as if searching for words.
It's hard. I don't regret avoiding magic, but I regret the other things I have to give up because of it, because I'm afraid of what I might do, of that damn slippery slope.
I reached out and squeezed her hand. She squeezed back.
Someone needs to help him, and right now I can be that someone. I owe it to him. And I've given up so much that I owe it to myself. Just to see.
She looked back at me and smiled.
I'm glad you're back, even if for just a little while.
I smiled at her. Let's go talk to some fairies and try not to get killed, 'cause this is a really bad idea.
Yeah, Lulu agreed with a smile. But at least we're getting out of the house.
The grounds were quiet, the lawn immaculate and rolling, the stone crunching softly as we walked toward the gatehouse and its enormous doors, two halves of a 20-foot-tall arch, with black hinges holding them in place. There was magic here, a faint buzz that left a chill in the air. I wasn't sure if that was cast off from the accumulation of the fairies themselves, or because they'd magicked this building just as they had the tower. The door on the left opened before we could knock. A male fairy in black fatigues looked through. His hair was dark and straight, his body tall and lean. His eyes were dark jewels among his pale, angular features.
"You are a bloodletter," he said.
"I am," I said. "She is not." No need to get into the details about Lulu's magic if she wasn't using it. "We'd like to speak to Claudia."
"Claudia does not commune with bloodletters."
"Okay," Lulu said. "Then how about you answer a few questions?" The fairy shifted his gaze to her, his movements methodical and his face expressionless.
"You do not have permission to encroach upon our land, and yet you seek to ask us questions."
"We have come peacefully to your door, and we have questions to ask," I said. "If you don't want to answer them, we'll leave. It's that simple." He looked at me for a moment, and then the door slammed with enough force to blow the hair back from Lulu's face.
"Friendly," she murmured, but didn't take so much as a step backward.
Magic began to pepper the air, and my heart began pounding in response, adrenaline beginning to flow. I could feel the monster stirring, a moth drawn to flame. "Not going to happen," I warned it, and pushed down against it. It was like trying to ignore an ache, trying to flex a muscle in spite of it. You could still move, but the pain didn't go away, and the monster didn't either.
"If I'm mortally wounded," she whispered, "you have my permission to change me, but make sure I get a good room in Cadogan House."
"Third floor has the best views," I said, flipping the thumb guard on my katana. 10 seconds later, both doors opened, and we were beckoned inside. The gatehouse's walls were as high as a 2-story building. The ceiling was open to the sky, to moonlight that speared through to illuminate the stone floor. A second set of double doors mirrored the first and led through the wall. Torches hung from the walls, sending flickering firelight across the space. But for the snap and sputter of the torches, the room was utterly silent, despite holding nearly a dozen black-clad fairies who stared back at us, all of them holding staffs or straight swords. They stood in a perfect semicircle, Ruidon in front of them. He wore a tunic today in gleaming emerald. Locks of his long, straight hair knotted into complicated braids. Gold filigree gleamed along the edges of his tunic. Gold thread had been braided into his hair, and his fingers glowed with rings. This wasn't the subdued Ruidon from the reception, the man whose purpose had seemingly been to compliment his queen. This looked like a man who'd taken control, and I wondered if it was a coincidence that Claudia wasn't among the fairies.
"Bloodletter," he said, in a tone that was equally insulting and curious, but not surprised.
He'd either watched our approach or had been informed of it.
"And not human."
"Human enough," she said, but her voice was quiet. I moved incrementally closer, so my shoulder